it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious periwig-pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who, for the most part, are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Handy, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're gonna hate this. It's John Malden and Dee Quillen, your hosts for the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
All right, John, we are very honored to have on the phone with us right now, and you're going to have to pronounce your last name. Is it Santana?
Santana.
There we go. Jose Angel S. Santana. Is that right?
That's right.
See, I'm
doctor.
It's PhD, actually.
Doctor,
well, yeah,
Santana.
That's true, but you don't have to refer to me that way.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today. What a treat to have you on our podcast.
It's a total pleasure. I owe you all a debt of gratitude for bringing this project that we're talking about to my attention, because even though I'm in it, I would have never known it existed.
That's very humbling to me, but just a little background. Jose was involved with the Sanford Meisner Masterclass DVD. He was actually one of the workshop participants in the DVD that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, it's kind of the fact that we actually got in touch with one another. For some reason, Jose, your email, when it came to my email address, my server thought it was spam and had locked it away. And I just happened to be going through the junk mail folder and saw that. And I was like, that looks like it might not be junk. And sure enough, it wasn't. So you can't always trust the spam filters, and I'm glad I didn't in that case.
Sure, absolutely.
So, well, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then just what you're doing now. We'll talk about the DVD project itself, and then we'll come back and talk more about what you're doing now. So, tell us what you've got going on in your life right at this moment, other than this interview.
Okay, not much else. Okay. See, that's a Sandy Meisner thing. This is what's going on in the moment, so this is all that's going on.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There
but,
we are.
I guess I'd like to preface whatever I say by saying that I don't spend a lot of time proselytizing about Sanford Meisner or his work. In fact, I don't spend a whole lot of time even talking about my work as an actor for the most part, because I left the acting profession in 1987, and though I did leave the profession, I did take Sandy's principles that I was taught at the Neighborhood Playhouse and from studying with him privately into my subsequent work, which at first was working with teenagers to help them resolve the conflicts of their lives peacefully, and then getting into doing work with the military and teaching military trainers how to deliver their training over two-way television, which segued into me using a lot of this work from the working with the kids and working with the military into using this fusion of the principles from Sandy's work with methods from conflict resolution, mediation, archetypal psychology, to deliver instruction to people to raise awareness and to develop skills for mutual understanding between one person and another. And like I did mention to you in one email, that the common thread through all of that work is the influence from Sandy Meisner. So that gives a little bit of context what I'm doing now and how I'm applying this teaching. But obviously, talking about this magnificent document of Mr. Meisner's work, we'll address all things that we all have in common. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I just like to throw in here, it's really intriguing that applying it outside of the world of theater and acting is what, you know, kind of refreshing for me, because I would never have necessarily made the connection that, because I've been so focused on theater and art
and actor training
I would never have in a million years necessarily guessed you could spin it off and get a military job, you know what I mean?
Well, it's, you know, that's I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm almost as amazed by that as you might be, because especially studying with Sandy, he was such a stickler for keeping the work of the actor separate from one's personal life.
Hmm.
And he almost considered it offensive that an acting teacher would delve into a person's personal life.
Hmm.
That for years, it never crossed my mind to apply these things to issues having to do with human potential or self-development. And I was approached by, you know, corporate people to teach them these things, and I did so reluctantly because I never trusted that it would do any good at all, to be honest with you. And I eventually even priced myself out of their being able to afford me, just out of a sense of guilt that I was not really delivering anything of substance. Because if there's anything you learn from any exposure whatsoever to Sanford Meisner's work, is that these are the things that you need to do on a day-to-day basis to habituate them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so yeah, that whole conversation about how this applies to everyday life, you know, maybe we'll get into that. And it is kind of remarkable. It's pretty remarkable how.
Oh, I would actually like to hear that if you can take a second to kind of give us an idea of how that would translate, because I'm with John on that one. I have spent most of my time focusing on and watching this DVD from the standpoint of not only an actor who is still striving to, you know, and struggling to get work and to build a career for myself, but also as an acting instructor, as an acting coach here on campus, and I'd love to hear how that applies.
Okay, sure. Well, here's an interesting way to get into it. Over the course of since having left the acting profession in 1987, so I started off working with, you know, young people, you know, at Jane Fonda's Ranch, Camp Laurel Springs, basically using, you know, drama techniques to raise young people's self-esteem. And that segued into my founding this program in Santa Barbara called City at Peace, which took at-risk kids and taught them how to resolve their conflicts peacefully, which segued into the government finding me and asking me to train military trainers. And then in Santa Barbara, I formed this school because there was a great need in Santa Barbara, it not being a mecca of the arts, for professional acting instruction. And I was continually approached by actors who were either showing me their showcases in the classes they were taking in Santa Barbara or just inviting me to different performances of theirs. And they'd ask me what I thought, and I just said, you know, I don't like to poo-poo anybody else's stuff, but I didn't feel like they were being well served. Mm-hmm. And so they approached me, and I began my school in Santa Barbara, which was called Actors in Training, the Meisner Technique. The reason I tell you all that is that the thread that ran through all of that work were people coming back to me and exuberantly expressing all of the benefits that this work had to their everyday life. Now, sometimes, in the case of the at-risk teens, this work was directly applied to their everyday life. But the thread that kept coming back to me is when I was working with the real young kids at Laurel Springs or with City of Peace or with my acting students, was that beyond, you know, anything having to do with performance, that this work so helped them to understand other people, to be sensitive to other people, to express themselves better. And something kind of amorphous, like it kind of seemed to enhance the quality of their life. And what was interesting to me about that is that one of the last communications I had with Sandy was I sent him a letter telling him that beyond anything that I learned from him about acting, that working with him significantly enhanced the quality of my life. Now, let me get specific about what we're talking about here. And I really didn't plan on talking about this because because I thought we were going to talk about certain aspects of the Meisner work. But
we will. We will.
It's a way of getting into it.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's kind of like coming in through the back door. But it's I mean, I'm always looking for new and different ways to look at things, and this is definitely something that I wasn't anticipating this interview to be either. So I'm fascinated by this.
Okay, and I think I could dovetail them because I did make notes the three key ingredients that I got from Sandy's work. Okay, so for instance, we talk about Sandy's work insofar as drama, right? I mean, a play basically is the structure of action.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Sandy's axiom for the craft of acting was doing truthfully under imaginary circumstances. Okay? People doing things in relation to one another. Well, just that axiom, the reality of doing, which implies the reality of doing truthfully, if you impart that principle to people for their everyday lives, think of the implications.
Yeah.
You know, think of the implications of people really doing what they set out to do. I mean, since so much of life is basically task-oriented, right?
Right.
Right, yeah.
The difference between... Boy, I'm giving away the store here.
yeah, we'll save some of it if you don't want to do that. That's fine.
You're going to make a fortune at this stuff, guys. Okay. That's what you're asking me.
That's right. You figured us out.
Okay. Spies. Okay, so, you know, so you think of the implication. So much of life is task-oriented. So if you could instill the habit, now, not like in a, you know, one-day-a-week seminar, right? Which is what I was being asked to do. I was coming into these, you know, corporate situations, and they were asking me to do 3 hours with them. And I teach them about understanding the nature of an action and how to really do that. Now, in that moment, these people were like, floored. They were, oh my God, you know, this is amazing stuff. I can't believe you taught me how to do this stuff. But I knew inside that was going to go away.
Right.
Right.
Right? Because what you learn from this work is that you have to habituate the reality of doing on a daily basis so that it becomes nature to really do what you're doing. And if you teach people, you know, to apply that to their everyday lives, it's somewhat transformative. You know, to use that term, which is overused, I think. Okay.
Well, I can definitely see. I mean, how that would be. It's one of the. It seems like I the more I watch TV, and the more I'm watching what's going on around, and in watching people interact with one another, even in class, we as human beings are not listening to one another. Right. I mean, that's one thing that I think that in throughout all of my acting training, that's one thing I've noticed is that people don't spend enough time really, truly, actively listening to one another in their everyday lives, let alone on stage. You know, and I think that comes along with that habituation. I think that's fascinating.
Plus, you're absolutely on it. I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to throw in there. I mean, it kind of to tie in. It's we also get into you talk about doing things. We also tend to put up barriers that stop ourselves and limit ourselves anyway.
Yeah, true.
I can't do this because I'm too fat, or I'm too thin, or I'm too tall, or I'm too short, or they don't like me because I have, you know, green eyes. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So if you take that principle about the reality of doing and just say, listen, I can really commit my full attention to doing this as best I possibly can, which Sandy refers to on the DVD program. I mean, I actually ask him that question about the independent activity. He says it focuses your concentration. If a person focuses their concentration on doing the task at hand as best as they possibly can, it makes a significant difference in the quality of their life. It's very simple. I mean, this is where you get into this work being somewhat like Zen, because that's the entire teaching of Zen.
Right. Right. I use in my acting courses the miracle of mindfulness, which is pretty much the whole, you know, thing is focus on what you're doing. Focus on teacups and enjoy washing the teacups because that's what you're doing at that moment.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, so let's segue in to the DVD since you brought it up again.
Okay.
Talk about first of all, let's start really, I guess, at the beginning. How did you get involved with that project? Because it was what was the date on that? It was what,
1980.
Well, how did you get involved with it? And I mean, how were you asked to be be on the? Go ahead, John.
Well, let's break it down into how did you get to the Playhouse first?
Sure. Okay, that would start there.
And it's just start there. How did you get involved in taking classes?
I got to go to the Playhouse. I was a mass communications major in college, and I was a VISTA volunteer my junior year in college, where I worked at a maximum security prison. And I was so burnt out from that I did a work study over the summer after I finished that VISTA volunteership at the Champlain Shakespeare Festival, where I got the acting bug. And after, you know, I mean, I was basically as an escape from this intense year of working at this maximum security prison, just thought I'd take a break at the Champlain Shakespeare Festival, caught the acting bug, and it seemed like whatever I did on stage seemed to get so much more attention than anything else I ever did. People would go out of their way to compliment what I did and wondered what I was doing in school rather than being in New York and being an actor. So when it came time to graduate, I sought out the Neighborhood Playhouse. A friend of mine, Michael Levine, had attended the Playhouse, and I broke the news to my parents and told them that, you know, I was going to be an actor. They didn't take very well, which goes to the comments on the blogs that T made. A lot of pressure from parents to not do this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I went for an interview at the Playhouse, and it's just an interview. And I thought I was going to go learn to act, you know, but it made a transformation. So my years at the Playhouse were 76 to 78, and Sandy had just come back from his larynx operation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had him. My first teachers were William Esper and Philip Gushy, who, by the way, Philip Gushy was Tom Cruise's acting teacher.
Okay.
In his private classes. And Philip Mr. Esper, excellent teacher as well. And then Sandy came in about 3 months in and scrambled things up. He wasn't very happy with the way things were going, and he switched classes around. So for the whole first year, the rest of the first year, my main teacher was William Alderson, and then Sandy was in classes twice a week, sometimes three times a week, sometimes once a month. Very erratic in the first year. Had him here and there. One never knew when he was going to be in because of his health.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to say that this is tricky, because I'm going to be talking about Sandy's work, and the same applies to me, that one day of Sandy Meiser's teaching eclipsed weeks of teaching with any other teacher.
Wow.
That was one of the most amazing aspects of working with Sandy at the Playhouse before I studied with him privately, is that he'd come in and make crystal clear concepts that were vague before. It was amazing.
That's a gift.
It was really amazing. So the first year class, you know, got whittled down from about 100 students to 22 students in our second year class.
Wow.
And in that second year, we had Sandy significantly more. And I guess based on our performance at the Playhouse, and then I had been, I left the Playhouse, you know, I entered the Playhouse with very little theater experience, very, very little theater experience. And I left the Playhouse, and fortunately, I immediately started working. I mean, my first professional job was with David Mamet off Broadway at the Public Theater in a play called The Blue Hour. And I had also, you know, done a film called Prince of the City. This is all before shooting this documentary. No, I think Prince of the City was after the documentary. Point being that I was working in the business immediately after leaving the business. After leaving the Playhouse,
mm-hmm.
and I guess they thought that I'd be a good subject for this torture on this DVD. none of that experience shows, I must say.
Yeah. Well, so talk about the experience. Talk about that. You know, we've watched the DVD. What mm-hmm. what was it actually like? I mean, how much of it was edited? What made it into the cut and what didn't? And how much interaction did you have with Sidney Pollack and all of those questions? Just, you know, talk about.
Well, for the most part, it was like one big happy family. It was shot actually over two summers.
Okay.
You watch it closely, in the second part, there's less people in it. Mm-hmm. And some people who had beards or who were clean-shaven have beards. So we shot one summer and then another summer. And there was tremendous contact with the crew and with Sidney Pollack and with Sandy and with all of us. It's a little bit strange because there we had all been that, you know, the bulk of the crew that's in this class in the documentary were already graduates of the Playhouse, and we were asked to perform as students.
Okay.
And at least that's the way I took it, you know, and as you can tell by my personality, it kind of, you know, I have somewhat of a challenging nature. So I'm thinking to myself, well, Jesus, you know, I know this stuff already. What do you mean, be first-year students? I guess we'll have to act as a first-year student. Well, you know, that, you come to a rude awakening of that, about that with Sandy right away, because you're a student.
Right.
And it was exactly like being in class with Sandy. That's what I can say. No matter how much experience we had. And, you know, that's true for even the more advanced students in the second part of the documentary. And, you know, some of those people, Barbara Baxley was in Nashville. I mean, these are stars. Mm-hmm. Kathleen Nolan was on the, a lot of, see, it's not credited, so people don't know this, but Kathleen Nolan was on The Real McCoys for years.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, Kathleen Nolan is on, you know, is on the blonde with the strawberry blonde woman.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Baxley, who talks a lot about not wanting to cry in her parts. Mm-hmm. You know, just a huge Broadway actress and movie star for a time, and was in Nashville. And Frances Sternhagen is a pillar of the Broadway theater here. So, you know, we're all students. It was, so that's what it was. It was, we basically were students.
Wow. Mm. Well, I think that's one of the things that comes across to me is that it's. It seems to me. I obviously have no experience from it, but it seems to me that it's. As close to what it captures, what working in an acting studio is and or should be. Do you know what I mean by that? I mean, it's. I went through some pretty intense training. I won't say it's the exact same thing, but mm-hmm. the training in my MFA program was fairly intense. And mm-hmm. there are moments in that I really can relate with, where it's just like you can see the frustration in the student. Knowing that they're so close to it, or feeling that they're so close to it, and understanding it, but yet feeling like they're 10 million miles away, you know, at the same time, and it's that frustration of working through those barriers, I guess, is something that I can really relate with.
Yeah, you're absolutely hitting it. I don't know about your MFA program, how much it was anyone was ever allowed to watch, but it's just, you know, it's rare to actually see a real acting class. Period.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because by nature they're private,
mm-hmm. right?
You know, and I can't tell you how rare it was for anyone to see a Sanford Meisner class, because the classrooms at the Neighborhood Playhouse were like Fort Knox. I mean, you couldn't get in. You couldn't buy a ticket to a class at the Neighborhood Playhouse. It was like really private.
Wow.
And same thing with his private classes. I mean, it was private. There was nobody allowed in there. Other than the students.
So how did I'm wondering how they got him to agree to do this. I mean that seems to me like that's a fairly. I mean
he was initially very against it, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Wasn't he initially very against this project when if I remember correctly, I can't remember where I read this, but it seems like Sidney Pollack approached him about it and said, "Look, we've got to document this. This information is too good not to have." Excuse me. And initially he was against it, I think, for that very reason, that it's a very private thing, that he believed it was a very, Sandy I'm talking about, that Sandy believed it was a very private thing.
Well, true. He was very resistant to the book because he didn't think that a person could learn acting from a book.
I agree with that statement.
Yeah.
he was very resistant to the book. And I think, and I don't really know, I wouldn't be qualified to address that. You may know more than I know about that. You know, just understood that, well, here's how the project came about. Kent Paul, who is a graduate of the Playhouse, who directed our shows at the Playhouse, at least directed my shows at the Playhouse when I graduated, this is his brainchild. Kent Paul, they eventually formed something called the Neighborhood Playhouse Repertory Company, with the idea of producing plays put on by graduates of the Playhouse. And as one of its first initiatives was to document Sandy's work. So Kent Paul basically put this project together.
Okay.
And he basically contacted Sidney Pollack, talked to Sandy about it, and contacted all the students. And I think Kent was the one who chose all the students, in fact.
Okay. So what about your own personal experiences in that? Share what you're willing to share with us in terms of looking back, especially from the perspective of looking back at it from so many years ago. Because I think you mentioned that you had, as soon as you had read our review of it, you went out and ordered a copy of it from Amazon. And,
yeah.
Because you didn't know about it.
I was a little concerned. Well, because I had, over the years, when I was, dropped out in living in Santa Barbara, I had been approached a few times about whether or not I had an interest in helping, this other footage besides the footage that's in the theater's Best Kept Secret documentary become somewhat of a document of Sandy's work. And see, my recollection of these sessions was that I was like so not with it that I wasn't really thrilled about that idea. I just assumed no one ever see it again. I mean, my memory of being in the theater's Best Kept Secret, Gregory Peck talks about studying with Sandy Meisner was like 2 years of unrelenting stress and strain. My recollection of these 2 years, of these 2 weeks of shooting mm-hmm. of Sandy was unrelenting stress and strain. And I knew that I was never too thrilled with my work. And especially in that exchange in the documentary where I'm the first example of an independent activity.
Okay.
I didn't remember it the way it happened, although when I watch it as it's on this documentary, it's rather intense. I didn't remember it that intense. But I do remember an aspect of his critique of me that is not in this documentary that I didn't want anyone to see. Because it was very personal. I mean, Sandy basically addressed issues that were personal to Jose mm-hmm. that were getting in the way of my doing truthful work.
Okay.
That lesson has stayed with me forever. And so When I read your review on Amazon T, mm-hmm. I said, "Oh my God, this is out there! This is out there! Is that critique going to be in the documentary? Did these people get my release to use it this way?" I was very concerned, so I ordered it immediately, really out of a sense of paranoia. And then, really, I was very paranoid. And then, when I saw it, I wasn't any less paranoid. When I saw it, I'm going, "Oh my God, I'm awful."
Oh, who hasn't been there, though, really? Watch your own work.
I guess, and that's why I am so enthusiastic about sharing information about it with whoever will listen, because mm-hmm. in spite of my, vanity, the benefits of watching Mr. Meisner work as if he were alive.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Far outweigh any of my personal considerations. I'm honored to have been chosen to fail repeatedly in the service of sharing his work. So that's my big juice with this, is that I watch this and I'm somewhat floored by the poignancy and the insightfulness and the specificity of his teaching.
That's what struck me about it was his ability to make the complex these really complex concepts seem just, it's like turning on a light switch. They just become instantly accessible and understandable. And I think that's his gift. I think that's one of the things that that I took away from the video was that was his ability to make that as easily accessible to his students as he did.
And the efficient manner in which it was done.
I mean,
it was
absolutely,
you know, three sentences and oh. You know?
Exactly.
Right. Well, I mean, even watching the video, I'm having the same reaction. I'm going, yeah, okay, yes, I get it, you know. And that's one of the things that had inspired me in the acting studio this semester here at MTSU was to take that concept of and to make sure that they understood that when we walk into the doors of the studio where we're working, they have every right and that actually they're encouraged to fail. As long as they take a look back and say, okay, now why did I fail? Why did that not work? You know, and to come up with that pathology of failure that I think is so crucially important, because it's, you know, failure in and of itself is not necessarily a good thing, but as long as you fail and learn from it, that's when it becomes okay.
That you're touching on, to me, one of the central gifts of the teaching of at the Neighborhood Playhouse, and to me what makes all the difference between a truly learning environment and a not learning environment is the extent to which the instructor can set up an environment where it's okay to fail forward.
You know, forward. I like that.
It's okay to fail forward. I can't speak enough about the importance of that, because if a student can't strive to learn through taking chances and that might lead to failure, then how are they ever going to learn?
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
That's a very true statement. I am also teach several classes here in our little acting studio, and you know, and I feel the same sort of way. You know, I do such things as weird yoga poses in our classes. Not because they teach anything, but they're because they're difficult and people fall over, and you know, you failed at that. Did anybody bite your head off? Did anybody say you were less of a person? You know, and I try to kind of create that environment that we're talking about, that it's okay to fail, but I hadn't had the fail forward phrase, but I'm going to steal that.
Yeah,
if that's
I'm
okay.
I'm going to steal that as well.
Oh, totally. You guys are funny. yeah. No, that's probably. See, we had two classes a day. I mean, we had class in the morning for about 2.5 hours, class in the afternoon 2.5 to 3 hours, 5 days a week.
Wow.
You have to be ready, you know, and you have to be ready with these independent activities every class.
Wow.
You never knew when you were going to work. You could be working twice a day sometimes.
That's intense.
Oh, totally intense. That's so intense. There was no way to avoid failure on a constant basis there. I mean, it was just unavoidable. And so you just become inured to it. You just, you know, get up again and try it again and get up again and try it again and get up again and try it again. And that becomes, at least for myself, that had become my way of working. And later on, when I actually was a working actor, one of the things that directors would bring to my attention that they so appreciated is that I came in with a lot of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I brought stuff in that oftentimes didn't work, but it was so much more useful to them than people that were coming in trying to play it safe.
I want to get you to elaborate on that just a little bit, because I know what you mean, but there are some of, especially for, and I'm thinking selfishly for a second, this has been for the benefit of my students this semester. What do you mean by you brought stuff in?
It's that, how would I put that? Is that tying it to the concept of failing forward, of taking chances, is that, as everyone knows, when you're working on a part, you're working on a part. When you're rehearsing, you're rehearsing. I mean, if you could read the script, the cast, and stage it the next day, there'd be no reason for rehearsal, right?
Right.
And so, if you're freezing the performances and the production on the second day of rehearsal, again, there's no reason for rehearsal. So, what a rehearsal consists of is a lot of trial and error. Okay? And so, from an actor's perspective, playing a part, if I'm playing, you know, a particular part, I'm bringing in as many ways that I could understand this part within the context of this play as possible. I could be wrong, and the director will give me a note. Ah, that doesn't work. okay, great, let me go back and try something else. Jose, that doesn't work either. Okay, let me go back and try something else. Oh, that's working better. Great, now we can work on this other thing. You see, so now, if I don't bring something in to try, the director's kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because all the director could do is either tell me what to do or just wait until something happens. And you know, characters are tricky things. I mean, probably a specific example, and this is a really great story, is that my first play outside of the Neighborhood Playhouse was a stage version of Rebel Without a Cause.
Wow, okay.
Okay, it was off-Broadway, Rebel Without a Cause. And I played the role of Plato, the Salminio role in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a complicated little part, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out a way how to play this. And I'm not going to play it the way it was in the movie because I'm not Salminio and that was his interpretation. I have my own.
Right.
Nothing's the same, you know, the characters, everything's different.
Right.
So I'm having an impossible time playing this part because he's a guy who doesn't communicate very well. And I'm trying all these, just, I shouldn't say wrong-headed, but experiments on you know, how to play a guy who doesn't communicate so well and tries to get, you know, what he wants in this piece. And that's when the director pulled me aside. He says, Jose, just keep doing what you're doing, you know, because I can't do anything with these other people because they ain't bringing anything in. But, you know, you just keep doing, you know,
yeah.
You just keep experimenting with stuff and eventually something will happen. Well, it got so bad that, like, 2 days before we opened, I was thinking of quitting acting because
wow.
I was just not anywhere near being able to play this part. I thought I understood him. I thought it was somebody who desperately wanted companionship, who, you know, detested the concept of being alone, the reality of being alone, and so therefore was doing these things, whatever it was he was doing, out of a sense of not being abandoned by people.
Mm-hmm.
So on my way to the theater, in depression, just really not getting anywhere with this part, I saw Harvey Keitel coming out of a lock shop in the Village in Manhattan. And I just followed him down the block in the opposite direction from my theater. And I stopped him about two blocks away and I said, excuse me, Mr. Keitel, I really love your work. I mean, this was like right after Taxi Driver, right?
Right.
You know, I really, really love your work and I really admired your work in Taxi Driver and so on and so forth. And he says, so are you an actor? And I said, yeah, I'm in a play and I'm really not getting anywhere with it. I'm playing this character who doesn't communicate very well. And he says, well, you know, gee, you're not communicating so hot now. I go, oh, really? And, I, you know, a little light, the actor in me, the light goes off.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says to me, what does he do? And I kid you not, I just looked at him straight in the eye, I said, thank you, and I split.
What a great story.
Yeah, he gave me the key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He gave me the key, you know, and with the foundation of the reality of doing from Sandy at the Playhouse, when Harvey said, what does he do? I said, oh my God, everything is in my head. I got this part. I understand him inside out in my head. I just got to figure out what he does in every scene to get this attention.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Oh, that's
okay.
Great.
And then every scene, I'm doing something to get my idol's attention. Now this started driving the other drivers, the actors crazy. Because now I'm really doing that. You know, I'm bringing a water pistol into class and shooting people with it. Okay? You know, I'm punching people. This not in the script, you know, but later on in the movie, he gets a gun, right? So he has a water pistol in the beginning. You know, I walk into a room. Instead of walking into a room, I kind of march into a room. And other actors are going, you know, what the hell's wrong with this guy? Precisely. Right?
That's great.
So that's like really embodying the part through action, which came from Harvey's tip, but I was able to take that tip because of the reality of doing.
That's great.
Does that make sense, guys?
Yes,
it does.
Absolutely.
Wow, yeah.
Well, listen, we're running short on time here.
Well,
Yeah, you got one. Okay, that's
okay,
fine.
Okay, I want to ask about the Al Pacino story.
Oh, yeah, we got to ask about that.
Which part of the Al Pacino story?
All of it.
How much time
tell
do
the
we
whole
have?
Thing. We've got enough for that. I'll put it that way. Go ahead.
It's a good call.
Okay. Well, I had been seen in that production of Rebel Without a Cause by David Mamet, who invited me to play a part in The Blue Hour off Broadway right after that, and that brought me into a working relationship with David. When Al was doing American Buffalo, first at the Long Wharf Theater, I was able to have an audition for that production, and over a long weekend they had to decide between me and the person who eventually was cast in it. So I'm condensing the story. You can imagine how many auditions I did.
Oh, sure.
Right, sure.
And all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy Waits got the part. And up at Long Wharf, they didn't have any understudies. So Tommy Waits got the part. And that was it. Then they decided to move the play off Broadway. And they needed to cast understudies. And they approached me about it. And I said yes. So basically my job was to understudy for Thomas Waits, who played Bobby in American Buffalo in the off-Broadway production of American Buffalo. Now, that was torture to watch somebody play a part that I knew inside out so well. I mean, and since David was a graduate of the Playhouse, if you read American Buffalo closely, it's written like a repetition exercise.
Yeah.
Didn't think about that.
You know, it's written like a repetition exercise. So I was like, oh, my God, I can play this part. And but the great thing about that experience, which I don't think you knew because I don't think I even mentioned this to you in the email that I sent you, is that Al requested or required that we rehearse the play every day. So basically, Al's suggestion was that we arrive at the theater every day at 5:30 and rehearse sections of the play that were playing just fine for the audience but that the actors weren't satisfied with. And I was able, and I was invited to these rehearsals as well, and I was able to rehearse with them, to improvise with them, to fill that world out. So even though it's equity, you know, rules that once the show opens you don't have to be at the theater till 7:30 at night.
Right.
We got to get for a solid year. We got together at 5:30 every day and rehearsed different parts of American Buffalo. And the amazing thing about that experience is that these parts of the play were playing just fine for the audience, but the actors weren't satisfied with the nuances of what was going on between them in the play. And then, so they were rehearsed, and very specifically, just using common sense approaches to acting, they would, you know, consider, okay, so what happened before this scene in the play? And they would really examine that, just the facts of what happened before. And then explore, based on what happened before, what's going on between us here. And then you know, that was it. I mean, that was basically the extent of it. What happened before? Let's explore what's happening between us here improvisationally, and that's where I was invited to improvise at times with them.
That's fantastic.
Okay, and then they would bring the text into it. And, you know, the evening performance that night would be very much the way it had been, but about 2 or 3 days later, it was like that section of the play would burst into this most amazing and poignant reflection of what Mamet wrote that wasn't there before. You know? And
wow. That's,
you know, and it was very early, you know, after my having left the Playhouse, so it was kind of like a first-hand experience of all the things that I learned at the Playhouse. And Sandy, as you see when he's on his DVD, he talks about, you know, what happened. He's always, when he's breaking down a scene, he's always talking about what happened before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the other main aspect of Sandy's work is its relational aspect, is what's going on between people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, that's built in. I mean, if if you come away from anything having to do with Sanford Meisner's teachings without, you know, developing a good measure of skill in relating to your fellow actor on stage truthfully from moment to unanticipated moment, you should get a refund.
that's great.
And that's everything that went on in those rehearsals with Al throughout, you know, throughout that year. Not to mention we played a lot of poker too.
Did you?
Does he cheat?
I'm sorry.
Does he cheat?
No, well, he, you know, he throws his influence around. He's
did
Al,
you?
Man.
Did you ever have the opportunity to play the role? Were you asked to step in?
I never got to play the part.
Oh man.
That was, you know, Jimmy Hayden, who eventually took over for Tommy Waits, brilliant actor, tragic story related to this brilliant actor, wanted me very much to come in and play the part, and somehow it didn't happen. So, you know, but I got to tell you that my learning that year suffices.
Absolutely,
right,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm, oh, yeah. I bet.
Yeah.
Listen, we cannot possibly thank you enough for doing this, and I said it before. We are this is going to be the entire episode. We're going to sort of forego our traditional. Well, if we have one, do we have a traditional?
Well, sure, we have 26 weeks of tradition.
26 weeks of tradition. So if we're 27, we're going to blow it out, and we're going to make this interview the entire main thrust of the episode, because I think it's that important. And we'd love to have you back sometime. I'm looking at all the stuff we didn't get to cover. You've worked with Stella Adler and all these other things. I mean, that's there's much more we could talk to. So
I'd love to talk to you guys anytime.
Well, listen, we really appreciate it, and we will continue to stay in touch, email,
okay,
and everything else like that. And if we have an opportunity later, maybe down the road, maybe we can get you back on the phone and talk to you again for a little while.
Anytime.
Longer.
It's a pleasure. You guys are great. It's a real pleasure. I really respect your you're getting it. You know, you're getting the substance of this work so passionately because I don't know. I just respect that a great deal.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and help spread the word.
I will.
All right.
Definitely will.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Jose.
Okay, guys.
Has this ever happened to you? You're not alone. We at the Inexplicable Dumb Show are here to help. Give us a call at 615-866-1282.